You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 20th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, my friends. How are you all?
Quite well.
Pretty good.
Good, Evan. How are you?
Super.
I'm doing fine. This is episode number 401.
Thank you.
Does that bother anyone? I mean, are we okay with odd numbers like this, 401?
A lot of people probably have a 401k.
That's true.
That's probably
true. Does anybody know
true.
What the 401 website error is and get it right this time? Because I don't want to get more angry emails.
Yeah,
I got that right. I said it was a bad request.
Yeah, I was.
Jay then went off talking about 404 errors.
Hold on a second.
I might have.
Well, all right. First of all, massive disclaimer. I have a baby. I'm not sleeping. And I hold on, I'm not done. I barely have a grasp on reality right now. I'm dead serious. Like, the fact that I got the first number correct, I should be applauded. Like, my memory is totaled. So, okay. Disclaimer over. Yes, I totally blew it. I can't believe it. I did confuse the 404 for the 400. I've only been doing this for 20 years. It is pathetic. It's pathetic, and I deserve all the negative emails I got, and I appreciate it because you know what? I'm not afraid to self-correct, so keep them coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't keep them coming.
And they will.
All right, everybody makes mistakes. I can admit that, and we can move on. Thank you.
Hey, speaking of people who can't admit when they made a mistake, on this day, March 23rd, 1989, Bobby Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischman announced that they had created N-fusion, which was supposed to be nuclear power at room temperature that produced 100% more energy than they put in. The press coined the term cold fusion, which stuck. Possibly because it was a bit more descriptive than N-fusion and a bit less like a failed Lex Luthor plot device.
Really? Was cold fusion, that term was coined with Pons and Fleischman? I thought it predated them.
That's a little surprising to me as well. But what really kills me is what they called it N-fusion, which of course makes me immediately think of N-rays, which were total baloney. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's like they were begging fates to come down on them and give them a smackdown.
Bob, you know that they made a machine that was run on N-fusion, and you know what they said before they turned it on? N-gauge.
Oh, nice.
I'll say it again. N-gauge.
N-gauge.
Striker. Riker.
I could be wrong about when cold fusion was termed. I got that from a source, but I didn't see a source on that. So,
okay.
I don't know. But yeah, N-fusion unfortunately did not stick. I like the sound of N-fusion. It sounds appropriately. I think you're right, Bob.
It sounds like
appropriately
sports drink or
pseudoscience-y.
Something. It does, Evan. N-fusion.
Yeah, it does actually.
It's awesome.
It probably is a sports drink.
It probably
yeah,
is.
Yeah, right.
Let's face it, anything that starts with N sucks.
Wait,
okay, there we go.
Well, you might want to think about that.
No, I mean, you know, like N whatever, not novella. I mean,
oh, right,
you know.
Right. Like energize.
It's funny, I was trying to think of something to prove you wrong, and I couldn't think of a single N word that would be an appropriate thing to say there. Maybe I don't have a baby as an excuse.
Yeah.
So anyway, N fusion. Of course, as we all know, after the initial excitement of working apparently cold fusion, scientists got to work reproducing the results, and they were never able to do so.
Oh boy!
So cold fusion now exists in the realm of pseudoscience, and Pons exists in the realm of France.
Mm-hmm.
Fleischman,
margarine,
pseudoscience heaven.
Yeah,
because he died. Last August.
Died of moita.
Oh, that's right.
But for the record, the term cold fusion was coined in 1983 relating to the work of muon catalyzed fusion and then but was popularized in with the Pons and Fleischman fiasco.
Okay.
Six years later.
Yep. Have you guys ever heard of the marshmallow test?
No.
Yeah.
I did.
It's
I
my
did
favorite
about,
test.
About an hour ago when I read your blog on it.
It's the most delicious of tests.
I was actually surprised. I had never heard it. I was like, really? How could I not hear such a seminal experiment?
Yes, it is a seminal psychological experiment, first done by Walter Mischel, then at Stanford University in the late 1960s or early 1970s, published the first series of papers in 1972. What he did was he took a group of preschoolers and offered them their choice of a snack reward, either a cookie, a pretzel, or a marshmallow. And then he told them, okay, here it is. You can have your snack. You can eat that whenever you want. But if you hold off, I'm going to return in a short while with a second snack, a second treat. And then he observed how long the children were able to hold off, you know, to not eat the marshmallow, to delay gratification because of the promise of a greater reward. So that in and of itself isn't what made the work so important and significant.
I would have eaten that marshmallow.
Yeah. He, in a follow-up study in 1989, where he actually followed the same children that he had studied now 17 years earlier, he found that the ability to delay gratification was highly correlated with academic success, success in career, successful marriage, staying out of prison, basically all the measures of overall life success. So that this ability at 3-4 years old to hold off eating that marshmallow seemed to be highly predictive of being able to generally succeed at life.
Can it be taught?
That's a really good question. Is this something that's just innate that you're born with, or is this a result of parenting, of upbringing? Were these kids taught that? And that's an incompletely resolved question. It's probably both is always the answer.
Yeah.
And this, of course, you know, again, the other thing that makes this such a seminal study is that it of course, then it gets replicated with endless variations. It becomes a core study that you could use as a window into human behavior. Mischel actually, in the original study, was trying to look at, you know, factors that predict how long the kids were able to stave it off and what strategies they were employed. He found that those that distracted themselves were able to delay gratification longer by doing something else, moving the marshmallow out of view so they weren't looking at it. So they actually engaged in strategies that enabled them to delay gratification longer, which is interesting.
Well, it seems to make sense because if you think about it, anything that you do, not anything, but most things that are worthy of effort take perseverance and take the sacrifice and you have to take the pain.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can't, if you can't fight the pain and, you know, get yourself over those hurdles, then you're never going to really accomplish anything. It seems pretty obvious.
You should be a motivational speaker. Fight the marshmallow pain. Well,
but didn't you guys, when I read that these were 4-year-old children whom the test was being, you know, given to, you got to think of the brain of a 4-year-old child. It is by no means fully developed. So have we learned anything about the state of a child at 4 years, you know, the brain of a child at 4 years and how developed those regions of the brains are that are going through these processes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, later studies found that older children are able to delay gratification longer. Not a surprise.
Yeah.
They found that the performance on the marshmallow test predicts body mass index 30 years later. You know, this is something that seems stick with people for life. Another researcher found that larger rewards were able to delay gratification longer, and there didn't appear to be any upper limit to that effect.
Well,
a million marshmallows.
Yeah, so if you say you're going to have 10 marshmallows, they can hold out longer. 20 marshmallows, they can hold out longer still, and they didn't find any upper limit to that effect. You know, to answer your questions too about, you know, what this all means, now I think we understand this as executive function, which is frontal lobe function, the ability to inhibit your desires for long-term strategic planning. A relative decrease in executive function is something that we would now call ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and the same negative consequences that were documented for people who didn't do well on the marshmallow test are the same exact things we see for people who have ADHD. They have higher rates of divorce, higher rates of incarceration, lower performance academically, etc. Now, I'm bringing this up all now, although it's fun and cool to talk about, because there was a recent study that put a different spin on the whole marshmallow test. What this researcher did was added a new element of trust. And so they primed the subjects, the students, the 4-year-olds, by giving them some crappy art supplies to play with, to draw with, like broken crayons or whatever. And then they said, oh, play with these for a while, but I'll be back shortly with some better art supplies. And then in half the children, they delivered the better art supplies. In the other half, they never did.
Then they
come back and do the marshmallow test. And I don't find it very surprising. Those kids who never received the art supplies, they ate the marshmallow right away. I mean, they had a much, much more diminished time that they delayed. And the researcher concluded that trust is maybe the predictive factor here. Maybe it's not something that's innate to the children, and hypothesized that children raised in an environment where they can't rely upon adults would perform much worse on the marshmallow test. And such an environment may also predict poor, you know, life performance later on. So that's interesting. I don't totally buy it. I do think that what you can conclude from that is that trust is a necessary component. If you're going to suppress your desire to eat the marshmallow, you have to believe that there's going to be a reward. And if you don't, you know, trust that there's going to be a reward because you were just lied about the art supplies, why would you believe them about the marshmallow? Then it sort of subverts the test. It doesn't mean that there isn't something innate or something in their early environment, you know, that makes some children better able to delay gratification than others that doesn't have to do with simply trusting the situation or trusting the adult who's telling them. So I think they identified an additional factor, but I don't think it replaces the executive function ability to delay gratification factor.
Wouldn't a good way to test that be to do the marshmallow test just as is and then have the kids self-report, like ask them questions that would gauge their... their general trust in adults.
Yeah, I think that's a perfectly reasonable follow-up experiment. I think you could also, you know, assess children's environment. What's their socioeconomic status? Do they live in a one-parent or two-parent household? You know, just essentially come up with some kind of reasonable estimate of what their environment is like, and then relate that to the marshmallow test to see if that predicts their performance on it. So yeah, I think one of the lessons here is that with these kind of psychological studies, there are so many potential confounding factors that you really have to study it from multiple different angles. And then even a classic seminal test like the marshmallow test, you know, 30 years later, somebody, 40 years later, somebody could put, you know, bring in a new angle to it, this other factor that wasn't previously considered, the trust factor. It's why they're really so difficult to interpret, even when they seem fairly straightforward, you know.
Yeah.
Because human behavior is almost always multifactorial. We're calculating multiple things. There's, you know, personality factors, environmental factors, learned behavior, the immediate situation, artifacts introduced by the study itself. Always very complicated. Doesn't mean that we can't eke out an understanding of how the brain works. It just means that you always have to take these things with a massive grain of salt and think about, you know, other ways that you could potentially interpret the results and study it to see if it holds up under, you know, looking at it multiple different ways. Bob, you're going to tell us about bacteria taking over the world.
Right.
Hasn't it already?
Again?
That depends how you look at it. But scientists have found evidence that bacteria may be ubiquitous in the crust of the earth under the oceans. And not only that, these are not photosynthetic organisms. They don't derive sustenance from the sun in any way. They're chemosynthetic creatures. We've talked about that a little bit on the show. Living off earth chemicals. And the kicker is that they may constitute the largest ecosystem on the planet. You hear that noise?
Mm-hmm.
That's humans dropping down to an even lower pedestal than we were on before. Not only are we made up mostly of bacteria, but we're possibly outnumbered by them to a degree that we wouldn't have believed even just a few years ago. We're like kind of like a minor photosynthetic infestation on the planet.
Oh my God.
Right? Really, think about it. They are the dominant species on the planet. And, you know, whatever. They're cool. I love them. But,
aren't they even the dominant species in our bodies?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's what I was saying. Yeah. They like 10 to 1, I think they outnumber.
Oh, yeah.
So this latest study was published in the Journal of Cosmology. Wait, no, not that rag. It was the Journal Science, Real Science, microbiologist and lead author.
Slightly higher impact factor.
Right.
Science has now changed their name to Real Science.
Yeah, Real Science.
Real Science.
Actually, it's science... No, Real Science.
we mean it. Microbiologist and lead author Mark Lever says that this could make it the first major ecosystem on Earth that's based on chemosynthesis, which is pretty cool. I like how they refer to it as the dark biosphere. It's true that there's places like undersea hydrothermal vents that support chemosynthetic organisms, but they're few and far between. They're kind of rare. Basaltic crust, on the other hand, is pretty much everywhere, and then now they may be home for more life than they ever imagined. Now, surprisingly, this was interesting. They didn't even really focus on the bacteria from the crust, but this actually supports their conclusion. Because if you're looking at bacteria, you mainly find out what's going on like right there and right at that spot where you're looking at the bacteria. So they focused on the dissolved molecules that they pulled up from the crust. And this stuff, this is the fingerprint. This is the leftovers, if you will, of entire ecosystems. And that's why they came up with this conclusion that this ecosystem might be the biggest on the planet. Another surprise for me was, these are modern organisms, they were saying, that found everywhere. And I would just kind of think that if you found these organisms that's been under the crust for forever, that you would find new species down there and things that just haven't evolved everywhere else. But apparently, the type of bacteria that's down there is pretty much what you find everywhere else. So what do these guys eat? A lot of them like they hydrogen, carbon, and other elements, but they again they focused on different stuff. They focused on bacteria that eat byproducts from the chemical reactions between water and rock. And I know it's not very tasty, but I'm sure Domino's doesn't deliver down there. But after eating, these guys excrete methane or hydrogen sulfide, which of course is that rotten egg smell. And Jay, I think you must have a lot of those guys inside of you. So besides being cool, I mean, how important or practical is this information? And actually, the implications can be very important. If this ecosystem is as vast as these scientists suspect, it can change the chemical composition of not only the rock that they're living in, but also the seawater that circulates through it. As a matter of fact, 4% of the entire ocean circulates through the crust. So our understanding of the ocean's biochemistry may need to be completely rewritten because of this. I mean, that's a tremendous impact. I mean, up until now, when we're thinking about things like, the carbon cycle and things like that, we think that everything comes from above, from photosynthetic organisms, but we haven't factored in the fact that these chemosynthetic organisms might have a huge input into this whole cycle. And for space, of course, it means that we may have to consider that this kind of life is even more common than we suspected. Lever said, for example, I think it's quite likely that there's similar life on other planets. On Mars, even though we don't have oxygen, we have rocks that are iron rich. It's feasible that similar reactions could be occurring on other planets and perhaps in the deep subsurface of these planets. And yeah, I mean, I think it's almost a no-brainer that we're going to find something, maybe not a no-brainer, but on Europa, it just seems to have everything you need for some sort of a microorganisms to evolve in terms of heat and different chemicals and elements and a watery environment. I just can't wait till we get there. I hope I see it.
Some scientists have speculated that while all life that we know of is related, we don't really know for sure that every bacteria-like, organism has the same DNA that the rest of life on Earth does. There might have been separate origins or
we talked
diversions
about it.
Yep. Much earlier, in the development of the basic components of life. You would think, maybe perhaps naively, that these bacteria that are so far removed, both physically, geologically, and in terms of how they survive from the rest of life, if any organisms would be different, it would be these guys. But as you said, they're really just variations on known species.
Yeah, but it's still, though, I think it's worth it to go down there and look at as many as you can, because it just seems likely that they're going to find some really cool stuff down there. I don't know why they could just make a blanket statement like, oh, these are the common ones that we find everywhere, when they really didn't even focus on the bacteria that much. They were focusing on the dissolved molecules so they can infer about the ecosystems that produced it. So I think there's going to be a lot more to learn about this, I hope.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Evan, you're going to tell us about transmitting HIV through acupuncture needles.
Ugh. That's awful, isn't it?
It's a lose-lose.
Yeah. Wow. So I had to ask myself the question, and I'll pose it to all of you. What's worse than being swindled by a scam artist?
Having AIDS and being swindled by a scam artist.
Yeah. Yes, that's right, Rebecca. If your answer is being swindled by a scam artist and ending up with an infectious disease, then you are correct. So a court in Switzerland has ruled that an acupuncturist, well, a self-described acupuncturist, perhaps deliberately infected his clients with HIV contaminated acupuncture needles.
Oh my God.
Deliberately?
Possibly, yes.
Well, it's negligent at the very least.
Yeah, at the very least. But they're going to try and make a case that he did this willfully. Over the course of a decade, in fact, to 16 people. The fellow's name is Maurice Geller, G-O-E-L-L-E-R.
Any relation to...
And he, no, none that I could find. He ran a music school, but apparently also while he was... teaching music or whatever he was doing at this music school, he had a little side business of, you know, proclaiming to be a healer who knows how to do acupuncture. So, unlicensed, right? He went ahead and worked on his students. He is believed to have used the needles between 2001 and 2005. The investigation found that, looks like he also served his victims, well, little cocktails, drinks to help them calm their nerves and maybe have them pass out so that he could infect them. So that's the case the prosecution is going to make against this person. He, the defendant, this Geller, he denies everything that is being alleged. So this is going to be quite a court battle. And, you know, and I'm sure a very challenging case for the prosecution to prove. Clearly, this is not how acupuncturists operate, right? They actually take their profession, well, the majority of them, very seriously, and one would hope they go through the necessary steps to make their practices as clean and safe as an environment as possible. Otherwise, what's the point? You want your patients to be able to come back to you if you're going to get them sick or not be be more harm than potential benefit.
Yeah, giving them then, HIV is kind of gives bad word of mouth too.
Well, yeah, or other things, but there are cases of infections being caused by acupuncture needles. Reuters, 2010, studies and experts say that bacterial infections and hepatitis B and C and possibly even HIV, this was back in 2010, were being transmitted via acupuncture. 2004, public health officials in Canada urging 1,200 patients of a Montreal acupuncturist to be tested for HIV and AIDS after learning the needles that they were using were not cleaned properly. So there's an inherent risk, and we don't talk about it a lot in skeptical circles. We talk about the fact that we don't believe there is any scientific evidence whatsoever of the efficacy of acupuncture, but there is an inherent danger when you go ahead and you insert little metal, very thin needles into the skin, right? We don't, that's something we kind of either take for granted, overlook, but there's an inherent danger there that I think needs to be pointed out now.
Oh, but we've written about it on Science-Based Medicine. It certainly hasn't been ignored from our end. There's a few articles looking at this that are documenting it. There was one review article looking at the Chinese literature, which is, if anything, likely to be as pro-acupuncture as possible. Between 1956 and 2010, they found 1,038 documented cases in the literature of significant side effects from acupuncture. These included, in addition to infections, the most common ones were actually syncope, you know, fainting. That's not a big deal. But a similar number got a pneumothorax. So that's when you stick the needle too deep and it punctures the lining around the lungs. So the lung collapses.
Ouch.
And subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is bleeding in the lining over the brain. So that this must have been, you know, doing it on the head, I guess, somewhere. So, yeah, I mean, how would you get a subarachnoid hemorrhage from an acupuncture? Where were they sticking it?
Like the base of the neck?
Yeah, I would guess the base of the skull would be the only place that I could think, but geez.
I've never had acupuncture, but you know, I've seen it being done, and it doesn't seem like a particularly bloody thing. So, I don't know, like, how easy would it be to spread infection that way, you know?
It pierces the skin. The skin is your number one immune barrier.
Yeah, but if there's no blood transfer, then how would – I mean, you need that for HIV, don't you?
Yeah, but if you pierce the skin, there's going to be some blood. even if it may not be obvious from the outside. The other thing that's funny is, you know, my colleagues and I, like I know David Gorski likes pointing this out. Every time you see a picture of an acupuncturist doing acupuncture and like smiling, like for an article, a pro acupuncture article, they're never wearing gloves. They're never using what we would consider to be proper technique in terms of minimizing the risk of infection. I stick needles in people all the time. It's, you know, I do several procedures where that is involved. And there's a certain technique that you use, a sterile technique. There's actually semi-sterile technique that we use, not like surgery sterile, but, you know, we always swab the area. We always, you know, wash our hands. We always wear gloves. We always use disposable sterile needles. And I don't think the same standard exists within the culture of acupuncture. They don't seem to use the same technique. So it's not surprising that there's a potential problem with infections. It is an invasive procedure. It's relatively safe, but it's not perfectly safe. So you have a procedure that has no compelling evidence of efficacy, but with documented risks that include death. There were 35 deaths reported in the literature, you know, due to acupuncture. Pneumothorax is a potentially, you know, fatal complication, for example, if it's not picked up and treated right away.
And yet our society continues to legitimize this practice, right? We license them. Insurance covers them. You can pay for them now through flex spending plans and health savings accounts. So the IRS has sort of lended a legitimacy to it as well. It's becoming more accepted, not discarded as it should be.
I agree. It's a total scam.
It's a disturbing trend.
All right. Well, talking about medical scams, Jay, I heard recently that Dr. Oz is being sued.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, though. This seems to be the first big public lawsuit against Dr. Oz that I could find. Sure that he's been sued a lot. It just, you know, not that many of them make it to this level. But what happened was a New Jersey man claims that an insomnia cure that Dr. Oz publicized on his show gave him third-degree burns on his feet. The details are Frank Dietl, who is from Southampton, New Jersey in the United States, filed a lawsuit against Dr. Oz because he followed a simple procedure that Dr. Oz mentioned on his show where you fill up a pair of socks, not fill, but I guess you fill the bottom portion where the pad of your foot goes with uncooked rice. You take those socks, you put them in the microwave, and you heat them up. So, you know, now rice inherently doesn't have a lot of moisture in it. You guys know this, right? You can use rice to actually take moisture out of things. Like if you drop your iPhone in the toilet, you know, you could put it in a it happens all the time.
Why would you do that?
It happens all the time. One of the things you'll find on the web is, hey, take your iPhone and put it in a bag of white rice, uncooked white rice, and it'll draw the moisture out. It's like those silica tablet things that come, you know, those packets.
So I actually checked into that, Jay, and what I found after reading dozens of references is that while rice, like silica, will absorb water that it comes into contact with, it actually needs to be in contact with the water, so it won't draw it out of the device. And rice is messy. It has a lot of powder that could get into the device, and it actually could cause more harm than good. So you're better off just letting the device, after drying the surfaces as much as you can, just letting it air dry for 24 to 48 hours.
Yeah, so what happened is you put these in the microwave. I guess they retain heat, or the heat comes out slowly. It emits heat slowly, and you put them on for like 20 minutes and you wear them on your feet, and supposedly the heat or the warmth from the rice will help you sleep, you know, cure your insomnia was the claim. He called these a knapsack heated rice footsie.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but, you know, of course, you know, I don't like Dr. Oz much, but that just sounds ridiculous to me. Anyway.
Wait, I gotta say, I have some little slippers that are filled with rice that are made to, you throw them in the microwave for 30 seconds and then you put them on.
They work?
And they feel amazing. It feels so good.
Well, of course, heating your feet does feel good. I agree. Like sticking your feet in warm sand when you're on the beach, and, you know, it feels great. I think the claim is dubious.
All right. I mean, I did do a PubMed search on this question just to see what was out there. And I found one review article and study that said that warming the feet and just skin temperature in general does correlate with a shortened sleep onset. So you will fall asleep faster if you warm your feet. However, this effect did not exist in elderly insomniacs. So in the target population here, people with older people with insomnia, this did not work.
So what happened was, unfortunately, Mr. Deedle he's a diabetic. What happens to some people, about half the people that have advanced forms of diabetes, is they get something called diabetic neuropathy. And that means that their extremities begin to get numb from nerve damage. So he heated these up too much, put them on, and he didn't feel the pain. And he kept them on long enough to give himself third-degree burns. So Mr. Deedle is now taking Dr. Oz or his production company to court for not, you know, issuing a proper warning, especially for people that have numbed extremities. Now, I have a lot of emotional reaction to this. One, I have this is a hard one because I think it's a fail on everybody involved. First, here's my big piece of advice for Mr. Deedle. Don't take advice from a pseudoscientist, number one. Okay, so he's not maybe educated in these matters, doesn't understand critical thinking and everything. I get it. I totally understand that. You know, he's watching TV. He's not talking to his primary care physician. He's trying a home remedy that he heard from supposedly a respected doctor on TV. You know, Dr. Oz is a doctor. He's a medical doctor. Seems pretty innocuous, right? Oh, I'm just going to put some rice in his socks here and put them on. And next thing you know, the guy's got third degree burns. Guys, let me remind you, third degree burns. This isn't your skin's red. This isn't your skin's blistered. This is your skin is cooked. It's black. That's a third degree burn. You have been cooked like a piece of meat.
Did you know that such a...
Yes, there's a fourth degree burn I know, Bob. Thank you. I know because of you, but, you know, of course I'm acting now like, yeah, that's when your bone actually cooks, right? Your bone burns.
Duh.
It's like no flesh at all.
Yeah. So...
Yeah, ouch.
Yeah, so the other big fail here is, of course, on Dr. Oz's side. I mean, you know, how much could I possibly criticize this guy? Where's the scientific research to show that this helps insomnia, number one? Number two, it just seems like he needs to fill up his TV show with things to talk about, and this is just another thing that somebody is bringing his attention to, and he's promoting it. There's no real research on it. I mean, this guy is not acting like a scientist at all. So, you know, what's the harm? Here's the harm.
I wonder, you know, getting back to the Oz thing, though, does he have any standard disclaimers on his website or his show? Like, none of the information presented here is meant to diagnose or treat a disease. Please consult your physician. That's sort of the standard if you're a media physician.
Yeah.
Disclaimer. Yeah, I'd be surprised if it's not there somewhere.
I don't know. That'd be an interesting thing to look into, you know, like the notes of the show.
I did look at his website. It does have the standard disclaimer in here. Do not begin any treatment without checking with your doctor, that sort of thing. Pretty standard, pretty thorough. But I'm not sure how much of that is on the broadcast version of the show.
I don't know that suing him is the answer, though. I don't, like, I'm torn on this because I have no sympathy for Dr. Oz, obviously, but I don't think this lawsuit has any grounds at all. I mean, Dr. Oz even said on his show, make sure you don't overheat the rice. It can get really hot, you know, and this guy has a condition that, you know, really, I think he should be responsible for taking care of, and understanding that not everything people tell him to do is something that he should do. I don't know. I just don't feel like what Dr. Oz suggested in this case is legally actionable. And I don't think it's certainly not the most morally reprehensible thing Oz or any other TV doctor has suggested. You know,
right.
It's a rice footsie.
I agree with you, Rebecca. Absolutely. I agree with you that this really was an innocuous thing that he said. I mean, will it help insomnia? Amazingly unlikely. And sure, it is it's a warm foot footsie. Absolutely. So some guy like takes it to the nth degree and goes too far, probably put the thing in the microwave for minutes instead of seconds or whatever.
Well, I think the claim is that he should have put a disclaimer in there about if you have numbness in your feet, then you have to be especially careful not to burn yourself because you won't feel
Which, see, and I think that's equivalent to the, like, warnings on irons that say don't iron your clothes while you're wearing them. Like, that's,
I love those.
You know, that to me is what that says.
Yeah,
like,
you can't
you have numbness. If you have numbness, if you can't feel your feet, don't put really hot things on them for extended periods of time.
And of course, this guy had to know. I mean, of course he was aware of his numbness. And yeah, you can't put a disclaimer out there for every moronic thing that any person could possibly cook up, of course.
They try, though.
But the other thing, Rebecca, I want to just quickly revisit the idea of how culpable is Dr. Oz. And I think the real thing that he did poorly was he shills these ideas that keep people from going to their medical, professional medical doctor.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, you know, if this guy were suing because he had insomnia and was taking Oz's advice instead of going to a doctor, then I would totally 100% agree with it. And I think it's probably only a matter of time before a case like that gets out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think this gets back to the same kind of point with acupuncture, that even though many of these treatments seem innocuous, recommending a bunch of nonsensical, you know, not science-based treatments to the general population is going to cause a lot of mischief like this, unanticipated stuff. He may not be responsible for the actions of this particular individual, but this is what happens when you put a lot of misinformation or nonsensical information out there in the public backed by apparent authority.
Yeah, I think that's what this is really about, is our culture's idolization of TV personalities and, you know, taking their opinions as fact in it. And following them, you know, no matter what.
Well, it'll be interesting to follow this and see what the courts decide about this one. Rebecca, you're going to finish up the news section by telling us about the new pope.
Yes, there's a new pope, in case you missed the smoke going up over the Vatican last week.
The news coverage has been crazy. I'm not sure why.
Oh, my gosh.
It's been
so were you guys watching the live,
really?
The live feed?
It's amazing the what the needs of one Vatican point.
Yeah. It was really funny. I was on Twitter at the time and watching the live feed, and it had the same palpable, pardon the pun, energy as the stratosphere jump did, you know, except for like at the end of this long wait, it's not a guy doing something amazing. It's just this guy coming out onto a porch and saying something in Latin and then turning around and going like one sentence. And then turning around and going back in.
When you're the head of an organization that has influence over 1.2 billion people.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a big deal.
That's huge on any, by any measure.
Guys, I saw a really cool picture. It was St. Peter's, and there's a sea of people, obviously, tons and tons of people. And from a distance, it looks like everyone's holding up a light. But everyone was like holding up their phones or their iPads.
Cell phones.
Or some and there's light everywhere, but only from one direction. Because if you looked at it from the front, of course, you couldn't see the lights. It was just a really cool picture.
How many lights were there, Bob?
Thousands of points of light.
Oh, seriously?
No.
Wait, Rebecca, how many lights were there?
There were four lights.
Thank you.
Oh, God. All right.
Oh, God.
I deserve a smack for that. Give me a
negative
smack.
Two geek points,
ooh,
Bob.
Yeah.
Ooh. All right. So anyway. So, yeah, the old pope retired. The new pope was announced. The pope was formerly known as Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio, who now goes by Pope Francis. Or Frankie. As
lighten up, Francis.
Pope Frankie?
Pope Frankie.
Yeah.
Hey, Frankie.
So I thought we should chat about him, because for better or worse, usually worse, the Pope often has a lot to say about matters of science. And as Evan pointed out, a lot of people listen to him. So let's talk about Frank. He is notable for a few reasons. One, he is the first pope from the Americas. Daniela Melli, the editor of Skeptic's Spanish sister site, Skeptica.org, told me that one reason this is really big news is because Catholicism has been in the decline in Latin America, and this nomination is predicted to, give it a huge revival. And so that might feed into the reasons why Jorge cum Frankie was chosen. He's also the first Jesuit pope. And if you're not familiar with the Jesuits, it's a sect of Catholicism that's considered particularly liberal and intellectual, which, depending on how you feel about Catholicism, could be considered damning with faint praise. But the new Pope is well known for his liberal stance on poverty, having taken a smaller apartment than he was given as cardinal, and riding the bus to work. I dearly hope he continues that tradition, because
really?
Can you picture him with his giant Pope hat sitting in his lap, big gold scepter leaning up against the pole?
Seriously, yeah. Like, did I hear Pope you right? Come on, the Pope is going to ride a bus to work?
Well, no, I'm telling you, the Pope did ride a bus to work before he became Pope.
Oh, my.
But,
okay, I'm like, hey, stop at the Vatican, will you?
There is a very good chance, though, that we could see some real changes coming from the Vatican in that regard. The Jesuits as a whole and Francis in particular focus on poverty and have a fairly progressive view of poverty. So that's some of the good news. The other good news is that, you know, when it comes to science, Frankie has studied chemistry, and he even taught literature, psychology, and theology before he became bishop. So there's that. As far as his other beliefs on science go, though, he mostly does seem aligned with the previous pope and with Catholic doctrine as a whole. For instance, evolution exists, but it's probably guided by God's hand, which, okay, fine, whatever. He's anti-IVF, in vitro fertilization, as are many other Catholics, because of all the leftover fetuses that get thrown in the trash from IVF.
Feti.
Yeah. So, he's known for washing the feet of AIDS patients, but he's also virulently anti-gay rights,
really?
The right of, he's against the right of same-sex couples to adopt, and of course he's against marriage equality, which Argentina legalized in 2010 over his objections. So I was interested in whether or not he believes that condoms help spread AIDS, as some other prominent Catholics, like the last Pope, have preached.
How does that work?
And it's really difficult to nail down how he feels about this. The first thing I found was his ex-spokesperson stating that condoms do contribute to the spread of AIDS, but that spokesperson was the ex-spokesperson at the time that he said that, so he was not speaking for Francis at the time. The Guardian reported that he's in favor of contraception only to stop the spread of disease, but the Guardian did not cite any source for that, so I couldn't follow up on it. And the only quote from him I could find about condoms is when he joked that his fellow priests worry about condoms too much. So I don't even know what that means. But I'm pretty sure that we're going to know one way or another probably pretty soon, because it's a huge issue. And depending on whether he agrees with the doctrine or with the science, he could either risk or save a lot of lives. So aside from that issue, all the most controversial points about Pope Francis fall outside the realm of science and inside the realm of human rights, mostly concerning his role in the Catholic Church's complicity with the Argentinian dictatorship of the 70s, Jorge Rafael Videla. According to Argentinian journalist Horacio Verbitsky, Francis helped hide the dictatorship's political prisoners from a visiting group from the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. There's also accusations that he was involved in the kidnapping of babies that were then given to families supporting the dictatorship. The mothers of the babies were often kidnapped and killed, and supposedly there's documentation that he was complicit in this. So, we have a Pope who has some backwards and possibly dangerous ideas about science, and a suspected history of human rights violations. So at this point, same old, maybe.
A wash.
But yeah, I mean, maybe he'll make some interesting decisions regarding the poverty issue. But yeah, for the most part, I'm not optimistic about some grand revival of a humanistic Catholic Church.
Well, here's a plus. Here's something I like about Francis that I didn't about the prior Pope Benedict. He doesn't remind me of the Emperor.
That's
so
true.
I can actually look at this guy without getting creeped out.
That's true. Yeah, there.
Which I think is a fair point to make.
I'll go further than that and say he doesn't appear to resemble any Star Wars villains. So he does have that going for him. Yeah.
You don't see a General Grievous in there somewhere?
No.
Maybe when he starts swinging six lightsabers around.
That was awesome.
All right, thank
maybe
you,
maybe it's
Becca.
A little Jar Jar-esque.
A little Jar Jar. So we have a special report this week. This came out a little while ago, but we're just getting around to talking about it. The website The Edge has been doing an interesting thing for the last few years. They ask a provocative question and solicit answers from 150 really smart people. And this year, for 2013, the question is, what keeps the smartest folks in the world awake at night? What should you be afraid of? What should we be afraid of? Or what should we worry about? There were some interesting answers. There were some not so interesting answers. Now I know you guys read through the list, so did anything stand out for you?
Oh, yeah.
Typos? seriously, 150 smartest people they could find, and not one of them was a proofreader? What the hell?
Rebecca, come on.
What the hell? I was severely disappointed. Severely disappointed.
Lack of typos is a sign of an inferior mind.
I don't think that's true, actually.
I know, I just made that up.
Here's one that jumped out at me. It was a WTF moment. John Tooby, founder of the field of evolutionary psychology, he said exploding stars, the eventual collapse of the sun, and the problems with the human id that prevent us from dealing with them. Now, am I misunderstanding this? Is he talking about us dealing with exploding stars and collapsing suns?
The thing that I'm worried about the most is that people worry too much thing. It was just so overdone. Too many people.
A lot of people trying to be clever.
Exactly. Yeah. So strike those off. You're down to 140 now.
Number 28, Kate Jeffrey said that we stopped dying. Like, she was concerned that humanity is going to cure death, you know, as an engineering type problem. And I just found that to be an offensive remark. It's ridiculous. And then some guy, William Pounderstone or Poundstone, said he's afraid of augmented reality.
You know, what the hell?
Of all of the technologies to say that you're the most frightened of, like augmented reality. I mean, I could see being afraid of the singularity, but augmented reality, I mean, that's, you know, to me, that's nothing. It's not a nothing thing to achieve, but it's not the harbinger of the end of the world, you know. So
there's a lot of technophobia in these, and to the point where it came across, like, a lot of these came across as like old fogies, like, get off my lawn. Like, what I worry about are the kids these days and their Twitters and their Facebooks. Yeah. Like, several people talked about the dangers
tattooing,
of social media. Yeah. And there were, you know, there are valid concerns to be had with social media and with the way that science, for instance, is communicated over social media. But it's not the end of the world. It's a new opportunity, and a lot of a surprising number of these of the people chosen for this seemed just absolutely terrified of not just the future but the present.
Mm-hmm. There was one that I thought was very poetic, and I thought it was definitely worth reading. It's a wonderful sentiment. This is the statement made by Timo Henne, who's a publisher. He said, "It is possible that we are rare, fleeting specks of awareness in an unfeeling cosmic desert, the only witness to its wonder. It is also possible that we are living in a universal sea of sentience, surrounded by ecstasy and strife that is open to our influence. Sensible beings that we are, both possibilities should worry us." Wow.
I picked that one out, too, as one that I really liked, actually.
Yeah, I really liked it, but I was a little confused in the beginning part when he was talking about the only witnesses. I mean, is he arguing that it's possible that we're the only life?
He's
painting the spectrum. You're right, Evan. We only know right now that we're it. So he's saying, sure, it's possible that it's all the way to here or all the way over to the universe is teeming with intelligence. And he was fearful and mystified by both of those possibilities. Just a wonderfully written statement. I loved it.
But I think the funniest one for me was Terry Gilliam.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
His complete answer was, "I've given up asking questions. I merely float on a tsunami of acceptance of anything life throws at me and marvel stupidly."
That was good. That was good.
Classic Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, well done.
Absolutely.
I like the ones that seemed like skeptics, or that some of these guys were actually skeptics. Some of them, for example, Douglas Kenrick, psychology professor, the idiocracy is looming.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
That was good. How about this one? "The coming fight between engineers and druids. and Paul Sappo.
Oh, yeah. I love that one, too.
That was fun. Interesting.
Right? And here's a good one. The Rise of Anti-Intellectualism and the End of Progress.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That was another good one along that theme. And there was more.
See,
there were many more.
I found a number of those to fall into the old fogyism category for me. You know, the Idiocracy idea. Don't get me wrong. Idiocracy, great movie, but bad science. And yeah. And I think that.
In what way? What do you mean?
Well, there's no real evidence to suggest that we're headed that way. All the evidence we have tells us that this age is the greatest scientific age that we've experienced yet. And that, you know, people are becoming more literate and people are growing in faster and better ways than ever before.
True. And I agree with that. But yet we had a president that did not believe in evolution and stopped stem cell research. I mean, that's how I looked at it.
And I agree that that is something to worry about, but I don't agree that we're headed for idiocracy, and that's something that should be keeping us up at night.
Here's something that's close to that, but different, and I think is legitimate. Sam Harris wrote, "We need institutions and cultural norms that make us better than we tend to be. It seems to me the greatest challenge we now face is to build them." And what I take from that is, our civilization is becoming damn complicated, and we need to figure out how to run a really complicated civilization. And right now, we're kind of mediocre at doing it. So I think that's where he's coming from. We need to build institutions and ways of doing things that make us better at running ourselves, you know, than we are now.
Yeah.
All right. What is the answer that each of you would give to that question?
I would go with climate change. I mean, it's not poetic. It's boring, but if there's one thing that I think we should be really worried about, I think that that's it. That's the one that's going to kill us all if we don't figure out something to do about it.
I agree that it's a potentially a serious problem. And I think that there's already what worries me about that is that we've already done more damage than we realize. That before, even if we like stopped generating greenhouse gases today, that what we've already set in motion is going to cause mass extinctions. But I do think in the long run that we will technology our way out of it. That
yes,
advances in technology will take care of it. Just as a matter of how much damage will be done in the meantime.
I think we won't if the anti-science brigade wins. And I think that that's the worry. I don't think we're ever going to come up with the technology to solve it if it's not considered a serious problem by a majority.
I disagree because I think the technologies that will fix it are ones that are beneficial for reasons that have nothing to do with
exactly.
climate change. Because they're sustainable. Right. They'll be, you know, effective forms of energy, and the energies of the future are just not going to be greenhouse gas emitting.
I hope you're right.
What do you think, Evan?
Antibiotics, how the resistances are going to catch up to us eventually. I mean, we're going to have our antibiotics are becoming less and less effective, and I don't know what is the solution to that problem. You know, something we take for granted. One of the things in our lives that we take so much for granted are the medical advances we have. Yeah. Among them, antibiotics. And the more resistant these bugs become to our antibiotics, we're going to be in big trouble coming.
Yeah, we may enter a post-antibiotic era for a time until we figure out solutions. All right, Jay, what do you got?
I wrote, the world is owned, managed, and gated by the mediocre in all human endeavors. What is right and best is ignored by those who control.
Is that another way of saying the masses are asses? Is that
in my experience, I've noticed that most people that are in control, that are in charge, are not the best people. Are not the people that should be there. I can get very specific about this, but anybody that works for a corporation, I think, can give very good examples for the most part. Not everybody, but the average situation that we find is that the people in power and making the decisions are not even what I would consider close to the right people.
That was actually Brian Eno's essay topic. He said, the thing that we should be worrying about is that the smart people want nothing to do with politics. They avoid it like the plague.
Yeah. But I'm definitely not just talking about politics. I'm talking about most systems that I've engaged in, most organizations, yeah, most things, I'm just not seeing the right people there. And a lot of times I see the right people in the organization on a much lower rung.
We need more meritocracy. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think what happens is, and I said it in my statement, that the world is owned, managed, and gated by the mediocre, that they're keeping themselves in those positions.
So I think what you're saying is close to what Sam Harris was saying, that, you know, the world's complicated and most people are mediocre and we need better institutions and systems to operate better. And that's, you know, what you're saying is that's because most people are mediocre and life is hard. So most people in positions of power are going to be mediocre. There's also, this isn't the Dunning-Kruger effect, but it's related to that, the notion that in any system, in any corporation or whatever, people will rise to the maximum level of their own incompetence.
That's a law, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember the name of that law. That
Carl's Law or something.
Because the way that people are promoted, every time they do well at their job, they get promoted to a higher level until they stop doing well, and then they get stuck at that level. So there needs to be a system to keep people at the levels where they operate well and not, you know, not promote them beyond their competence.
That is known as the Peter Principle.
Principle? That's right.
Yeah. People tend to get stuck in positions that they're not good at.
There are actually some companies that have changed based on the Peter Principle, and they've instituted things such as, instead of taking your best junior manager and making them manager, you force everybody to go through like manager training before they get into the position of manager. So then mm-hmm. they know exactly what to do in that position, and they're at the top of their level before they get into the position.
Yeah.
And then they get in there and they start training for the next one. So it's like simple sort of ideas like that, that there are, that some companies have instituted based on the Peter Principle.
Yeah, exactly. You don't promote people based upon how they're doing in their current job. You promote them based upon some assessment of how they're likely to do in the position you're going to promote them into. Exactly.
Yeah, and specifically training them before they're
right.
promoted into that position.
Yeah, yeah. That's important.
All right. And Bob, what do you got?
Worldwide shortage of peanut butter.
What? Yeah. That's not going to – is that happening? That's not happening, is it?
What about all the allergic
people? I got you.
People?
Awesome, awesome.
Jesus Christ, I had a heart attack.
JC.
I love peanut butter so much.
I did not know that. I knew I had a good reason to love you. One thing that freaks me out a bit is from everything I read, it just seems like with the accelerating technological development that we're on the cusp of some amazing shit. Some stuff. Oh my God. It's just the next couple generations are amazing.
Bob. I have never heard the word shit said with such enthusiasm.
I know. I feel like you were just epic. Trying to sell us pot. This is some more amazing than this shit, you guys.
So I'm just afraid we're going to be like the last generation that's remembered. Like, oh, that poor whatever generation that didn't make it and to, you know, to like, to see all this amazing stuff and centuries of life and just all this crazy stuff that hopefully our kids and grandkids will see, but that we're going to miss because we're like that last generation that just misses all the really amazing, crazy stuff.
And that'll always be the case.
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think the scope of change that's going to happen in the next couple of generations is going to be so dramatic. It'll be hard to match that kind of acceleration, once we reach a certain point, I think.
Just barely miss being immortal. Yeah.
Right?
I thought it was going to be turning 50 this year, Bob. That's what I thought. It was
it's kind of related.
Right?
I have a couple runners up before I tell my big one. So one that I was surprised that nobody mentioned on the 150 list was the fact that our food supply is increasingly dependent upon the decreasing diversity. You know, the monocultures that we that the tomato is replacing all the local varieties. Mm. And so we're one blight away from famine, basically. We're setting ourselves up for in a really bad way that we're dependent on, you know, these really narrow, genetically diverse, crops. And hopefully, though, there's people keep talking, like one of the things people talk about, I hear a lot about it, but I don't really see any big move to diversify just for the sake of genetic diversity, our fruits or our food base, you know, our agriculture.
Well, nobody mentioned it, but Kevin Kelly of Wired thinks underpopulation is
a problem.
We should. Some of these essays were so stupid that I just could not even handle it. Underpopulation.
The other one, which is almost, you know, it's almost too cliche for me to say it, is, you know, the pseudoscience thing. But the specific angle I'll put on that is I think science wins out in the long run. I think that the long trajectory is that you know, science works and it will win.
It delivers the goods.
Yeah. But I am worried that things like acupuncture and homeopathy will become institutionalized within my profession to the point that it will be hard to get rid of them. It'll be 100 years or 500 years before we ever really get rid of them. It'll be like a toe fungus that just never goes away.
Unsinkable rubber ducks.
But in terms of like existential, if you want to ask like, what's the existential thing I worry about? It is honestly the coming robot rebellion. I just think it's hard for me to imagine a future where somebody somewhere, and it may not even be our own species, you know, creates a self-replicating robot which gets out of control, and they would just have such a massive advantage over biological life. Why won't they take over the universe? That's what I can't figure out. Why isn't the future necessarily going to be dominated by machine life?
We have to make sure we put an off switch somewhere.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, like that is to me, that's the sort of thing we solve by technology. Like
I agree.
No, like we have to global merge with warming.
The yeah, well, we you know? We will merge with machines, et cetera, et cetera. We'll do all those things. But I'm saying it just takes one person somewhere to create Cylons or whatever to do the thing that they shouldn't do, and that genie gets out of the bottle, and then we're effed.
And of course, Steve, that also applies not to just, you know, macro scale robots, but bacteria sized nanomachines that infect everyone on the planet.
Gray goo sort of thing is scarier to me than the idea of.
You see, the cool thing about gray goo is that if you have your own gray goo, you could defend against it. It's the fact that if somebody has gray goo and nobody else has it, that's when we're totally screwed.
We cannot afford a gray goo gap.
Gray goo gap. Yeah.
All right, Evan, it's that time.
Then let's get to it. Let's play for you last week's Who's That Noisy. Here we go.
I know what it is, but I'm not going to say.
A lot of our listeners did understand the scientific context of these three little clips of tracks that are currently out there in space, floating around on the Voyager's golden record.
Oh.
So, yes.
Why didn't you use Chuck Berry then? I would have got it then.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That's why I didn't use Chuck Berry.
Oh, too easy.
There's a lot of stuff on this record. You know, a record. think about it. If we launch these things today, gosh.
If you were to hand it out at the mall, people wouldn't know what to do with it. Forget about aliens figuring out what to do with it.
Thanks for the cool frisbee, dude.
Yeah, the average 16-year-old would have no idea what to do with that.
So for those of you who are not aware, aboard the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 spacecrafts are these golden records in which there are the sounds of the Earth. Amongst other bits of information on there, and there's a lot of stuff. There's greetings in various languages. There are natural noises that occur on the Earth, animals and sounds and technologies such as trains and tractors, and there's a bunch of songs. So I chose three songs that are on the disc and put them together in a little montage for everyone. So what you heard was first by Johann Sebastian Bach, Brandenburg Concerto No. 2 in F, first movement, of course, followed by a wedding song of Peruvian origin, and then finally a song called Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground by Blind Willie Johnson.
We should point out that the Voyager spacecraft also have the player for the disc. It's not just like there's a disc and the aliens have to figure out what to do with it.
Nice pictures.
That's a good point. And of all the correct guesses, Lauren Collins, we drew your name as the winner for this week. So congratulations on getting that correct.
Good job, Laura.
And what do you got for this week?
All right. This week, another Who's That Noisy. Here we go.
Born. When I started to talk to him, I started to learn that there are a lot of misconceptions about the dangers of vaccinations, and in particular, the association with autism. And
okay. Mm-hmm. That's all you get. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Give it your guess. WTN@theskepticsguide.org or SGUforums.com. We have began a little sub-forum amongst our forum for Who's That Noisy answers specifically. So, our fellow webgoers, take a look for that and make sure you post your answer in the correct subforum for this from now on. We're going to be doing that every week with a little message from me at the beginning of each forum. And well, that's about it.
Threat.
Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Yes.
Yes.
As ready as I was last week. Didn't help.
Okay. Scientists have successfully tested a coal combustion process that extracts energy from coal without burning it while capturing 99% of the carbon dioxide produced. All right, number two, is a new study finds that eye injuries from laser pointers have been increasing with over 500 reported cases in 2012 in the U.S. And item number three, a recent analysis of published English language books shows a steady trend toward decreasing use of emotional words throughout the 20th century. Evan, go first.
So how can you get energy from coal without burning it? I guess that's the key. You would have to crush it. Destroy it, not burn it. Maybe there's a way of freezing it, like putting in a really deep cold freeze. No. The next one about laser pointers and eye injuries. They're increasing, huh? Well, they're increasing to 500 reported cases. I have no idea what the cases were prior to that. There was a time not too long ago, I guess in the 90s, these things were a fad almost. You know, every kid kind of wanted to have one. It was a cool thing to have. They became these affordable little toy that you could buy for like $2 or $3. I think maybe that was perhaps the peak. Tending to think that one's the fiction, but the last one about published English language books, decreasing use of emotional words throughout the 20th century. I kind of think that one's going to be right. I think there's lots of changes going on in the way we use not just emotional words, but lots of different words. Well, I'll stick with my thought here and say the laser pointer is one. That is the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
All right, the coal combustion, I got a little bit of a problem with that. I'm trying to reconcile combustion without burning. I thought they are kind of inextricably linked. So that's a problem. And 99%. The laser pointer, I don't know. I just don't see those very much anymore. Like kind of like a fad, but I know that's purely anecdotal. Yeah, but 500 doesn't seem too out of the ordinary to me. It's kind of a low number across the entire United States. The lack of emotion one, I could see maybe more emotional language before the 20th century in literature. Yeah, I don't have too much of a problem with that. Yeah, I think I'm just going to go with the combustion one. But I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
The coal thing seems reasonable to me. And it's not because I know much about the technology. I don't really know anything about it. But it makes sense to me because the coal industry is so powerful. And they know that their time is coming when they will be out of a job unless they come up with something better. And so I feel like there's got to be a ton of resources behind doing studies like this. So I agree with the guys, like laser pointers, are they popular anymore? I don't know. Like Evan's right. I remember them being really big in the late 90s. And these days, I don't see them at all anymore. And I also find the emotional words thing really suspicious too. It's just this side of believable. It's a very good item, Steve. I will give
you
that.
Thank you.
So yeah, I'm between the laser pointers and the emotional words thing. And I guess I'm going to go with the laser pointers thing because I agree with Evan. Nobody cares about laser pointers anymore.
Okay, Jay.
Very difficult. Well, okay, the coal burning. I can't see a reason why they wouldn't be able to come up with a way to have a highly efficient process of capturing the energy and the carbon dioxide produced from coal. Sure. The whole thing about laser pointers, I know it's funny. Everybody seemed to have one 10, 15 years ago. And I'll tell you why I'm picking the third one about the emotional language books show a trend towards the decrease of emotional words. I'm going to use one example. The Twilight series. We have a lot of books being written now for the teenage audiences that are filled with this type of media. If you like it or not, I don't know. But I mean, I don't have, you know, I can't catalog the hundreds of thousands of books that have been written in the last 10 years or millions of books that have been written. But it doesn't seem that way to me. That one rubbed me the wrong way. And the other two, I think I have a handle on. So this is the only one I'm unsure about. So this one's the fake. And the die roll.
Jay, wasn't Twilight written in the 21st century?
Excuse me, Bob. I'm rolling dice.
That's a good point. And also, I haven't read the books, but I did see part of one of the movies. And
I saw a trailer once.
I saw no emotion. Kristen Stewart's face did not flash a single emotion.
Does she always look constipated? Is it
No, she does. Yeah. That's her method acting. She doesn't like go to the bathroom for a month and then she gets on camera. Number two. So, is this the 10th one, guys? I can't remember.
We'll have to go back and tabulate them.
Okay. All right. So number two, I picked number three. Once again, me and random choice are not aligned.
Before we give the results for science or fiction this week, well, Jay, we have 2 weeks left until Nexus. And we have a couple of important announcements to make about it. Pretty exciting. The first involves the SGU private recording. Now, this is not the live recording we're doing on stage for all of the people who are attending. But on Saturday night, we're doing a private recording. We've been doing this at live events. It's been really very popular. People love to be in a small room with us while we record the show. So we had sold out very quickly the 25 seats for the live show. But Mike has informed us that we've had to change the venue. We've actually upgraded the venue for the private recording to a bigger and better space.
Yeah, well, we've done it in hotel rooms, and last year, and this was at Nexus last year, it was like a hothouse. Remember, we had the room was,
It was a little tight. Yeah, it was a little tight.
So Mike decided let's try to find a better venue for the thing, and he did. And so now we picked up two extra seats.
That's right, and two people also changed their plans, so we therefore have four unsold tickets to the SGU live recording. Also, the change in venue did mean that we have to move our show up from 10 p.m. to 9 p.m., so for those who do have tickets to that show, it will start at 9 p.m. on Saturday. And since we sold out, we've had tons of requests for tickets. So to be fair, we're going to do a couple of things. We're going to have a raffle of sorts for two of the tickets. So for everyone who has already pre-registered for Nexus and anyone who pre-registers up to April 1st midnight. So if you register before midnight on April 1st, then you will be entered into a drawing for those two SGU private recording tickets. The other two are going to be auctioned off on eBay. So just look at the show notes there and you'll see the exact link, or you could just search for it, but it'll be the SGU private recording tickets. Now, in addition to the SGU private recording, the winners of either the eBay auctions or the registration raffles are going to get not just tickets to the private recording, but Nexus VIP all access tickets. What this means is you will have access to the entirety of Nexus, and this will be totally for free. So you obviously have to pay when you register, but you will get reimbursed for whatever you registered for, and you'll have access to all Nexus events. That means all the workshops on Friday, the Stimulus Response Show on Friday night, all of the shows Saturday and Sunday, including the SGU private recording. In addition, as VIP attendees at Nexus, you will get to attend a private lunch with George Robb and myself after our workshop on Friday morning, and George will perform a private show just for the four people who get these VIP tickets.
Wait, I mean, like, can I not go to that?
Yeah, of course. And any of the SGU people who will be in town at that time will also attend. But this will be – George and I will have to be there for our workshop.
And then what are you going to be doing? Percussion, Steve?
If George wants me to, I could always contribute a little percussion.
Okay.
So you get that. And you'll get to have lunch with the SGU on Saturday, which is just – this will be a private lunch for just the SGU plus the four winners. And that will be right before our live show, so you'll actually get to see us do our finish our prepping for the live show on Saturday.
Which is usually like a lot of us like swearing and yelling at each other because we didn't get to talk about the news items that we wanted to.
Right. It's a pretty dynamic discussion usually right before. We're usually doing some last-minute brainstorming and checking everything. It's our lunch too, so it'll be fun.
Yeah, and everything else, Steve. They're going to get to go to the speakers' dinner. They're going to have more access to the speakers. They're going to be able to meet and talk to the people that they're going to see talking on the stage at Nexus, which is pretty cool. I don't know what because this is a new venue. I'm not sure about the backstage situation, but
yeah, I know there's no green room for some reason this year. But essentially, you'll have VIP access to any place you know that the speakers have access to during the conference.
So to sum it up, go to nexus.org. If you register, you're going to be entered in for the two tickets that are available there. The other two tickets are going to be an auction on eBay, and we will link to those on our Facebook page, the SGU Facebook page. And Steve will blog about it on Neurologica, and we'll just try to get that link out as fast and furiously as we can.
And even if you're not going to be one of the VIPs attending the conference, please do come. It's going to be a great conference this year. Speakers include Leonard Mlodinow, John Ronson, Simon Singh, Mariette DeChristina from Scientific American, Michael Shermer, John Allen Palos, and many, many others, including a live show by the SGU. We have a great lineup this year. Still seats left, so please register, and we'd love to see you there. So you're all over the place, so I will just take these in order. Number one, scientists have successfully tested a coal combustion process that extracts energy from coal without burning it while capturing 99% of carbon dioxide produced. Bob thinks this one is the fiction, and this one is science.
Uh-huh. Crap!
Wow.
So this process is known as direct chemical looping combustion, and they don't burn it, meaning they don't set the coal on fire. They do combine the carbon in the coal with oxygen, but they do it with metallic oxygen chemicals, rather than with fire, rather than with burning. So it's not combining with oxygen from the air. It's extracting oxygen from chemicals, which also transfer energy to the coal, which, heats it up. Then they move the coal, to another chamber where, you know, theoretically the heat can heat, water, steam, turbine, it's how all power plants make electricity. And then they actually can, you know, bring it back around. It's very efficient in turning it into ash, which can then be separated out and capturing 99% of the carbon and also a lot of the other contaminants, pollutants. Sulfur dioxide and the NOx. I'm not sure how you're supposed to pronounce that. NO subscript X. NOx. So very interesting. And they did it. They did a reasonably sized test. They ran the machine for 200 hours without any problems. So it seems to be a viable process. I don't know if it's cost effective, but it does seem to. And I think you're right, Rebecca. This is, you know, researching ways to make clean coal. This is all part of a clean coal technology. Let's move on to number two. A new study finds that eye injuries from laser pointers have been increasing with over 500 reported cases in 2012 in the U.S. Evan and Rebecca think this one is the fiction, and this one is the fiction.
Oh, yes.
Job, guys. Yeah. Well done.
Good job, Evan.
So it's been decreasing, right?
Well, it's never been very high. The reference that I found, so there's a different news item, which I'll get to in a second, but I did just independently look up, well, how many injuries are there? And there are averaging around six reported cases per year, and it's not increasing.
Six?
Yeah, very, very few. The news item was simply a NIST report, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They are looking at laser pointers, both red and green pointers that are on the market. And they found that 90% of the green pointers and 44% of the red pointers actually exceed federal safety regulations. They are not
Sweet.
Compliant. They are putting out too much energy, too much brightness in the visible spectrum or the infrared spectrum. Those are the two that they worry about. Actually, by coincidence, I was at a lecture last week, and somebody was using a green pointer, and it hurt to look at that on the screen. It was very uncomfortable. Like, wow, that is bright. It was really bright. It was uncomfortable to look at.
It radiates, yeah.
Yeah.
It has a life of its own, almost.
The red ones I find more pleasant to look at. So anyway, so they are brighter than they're supposed to be. But that doesn't necessarily translate into injuries, because I think most people know that they're not supposed to shine them on their retina. Most of the injuries are from people, in fact, doing that, you know, looking at the laser shining in their eye because they don't know that they're not supposed to do it.
Curious.
Or they don't care for whatever reason. But, you know, just like having somebody sweep it across your visual field is not going to cause damage.
Does that mean I can stop worrying about – I actually do have a serious concern about hurting my cat's eyes when I use the laser pointer.
Yeah, you're probably not going to hurt their eyes.
Okay. Well, they're dumb. They might look at it. I don't know.
Let's move on to number three. A recent analysis of published English language books shows a steady trend toward decreasing use of emotional words throughout the 20th century. Jay was the only one who thought this one is a fiction, and of course this one is also science. Jay, do you know what resource they used for this study?
Where they get the data? The internet.
Specifically Google. You know, Google's Word.
Thank you.
You know, project, yeah. They were able to crunch massive amounts of data, just counting words, you know, specific words. In this case, emotional words like anger, disgust, fear, joy, sadness, and surprise. And they found a very consistent trend over the entire 20th century of decreasing use of emotional words.
From all English language books?
Wow. Well, they did a sampling. I'm obviously going to look at every single book in existence, but they, yes.
But like a cross-cultural, cross-discipline.
Yes, yes. And they tried to control for the fact, so they want to know, is this a real trend or an artifact of maybe there's more technical books being published these days? So then they just confined it to just fiction, and the trend still held up. So even just when looking at fiction. Then they separated out American literature and English literature, and they found that the trend was there for both. But American and British literature has started to diverge in the late 1960s. And there's been a little bit of a decrease in the trend in American English literature. And there's one word, one of the emotional words actually took an upturn, has been increasing in the last 20 years.
The word is internet.
No, this is one of those emotion words
emotional
that I listed.
Words.
One of those emotional words that I listed. Which one has reversed the trend?
Wait, list them again.
What was the list? Yeah.
Anger, disgust, fear, joy, sadness, surprise.
So which one has increased?
Yes, that's what I'm asking. One of those has reversed trend and increased in the last 20 years.
Joy.
Yeah,
Surprise.
Fear.
Ah.
Fear.
So much for my optimism.
All right, Jay, you got a quote for us?
This is a quote sent in by a listener named Fisher Wise. It could be a real name. It's cool.
That's a cool name.
I like it.
Sounds like he's in a Cormac McCarthy book.
Sends in a fantastic quote from the legendary Christopher Hitchens. I still mourn his death. I appear as a skeptic who believes that doubt is the great engine, the great fuel of all inquiry, all discovery, and all innovation. Christopher Hitchens!
Yeah. That's an excellent quote.
Mm-hmm. Great quote.
The Hitch. All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining me again this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.